You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network, and occasionally we like to tell our listeners about podcasts we really like, and a podcast we really like is called The Endless Knot. It's hosted by Avin McMaster and Mark Sundaram. Mark is a medievalist, and Avin is a classicist, and on their podcast, they talk about all manner of things, medieval and classical, and occasionally other intellectual topics, which I think you'll find very interesting, and they're really entertaining hosts, let me say that. You can find The Endless Knot on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, and other places where you find podcasts, or you can just go directly to their website, which is alliterative.net. That's alliterative.net, and you can download episodes there. The episode you're about to listen to is from The Endless Knot, and I hope you find it entertaining. Thanks very much.
Welcome to The Endless Knot Podcast,
where the more we know,
the more we want to find out.
Tracing serendipitous connections through our lives
and across disciplines.
Hi, I'm Avin.
And I'm Mark.
And today we're talking about Bob Dylan. For today's episode, we have a really fascinating interview with an academic who has found a way to connect his knowledge of classics with his love of classic folk rock.
Richard Thomas is the George Martin Lane Professor of the Classics at Harvard University, where he studies and teaches Latin poetry and classical reception. For a while now, he's been teaching a freshman seminar on Bob Dylan, and after Dylan was awarded the 2016 Nobel Prize for Literature, he set about writing a book to demonstrate some of the reasons that honor was deserved.
Why Bob Dylan Matters is the result, and it explores the classical allusions in some of Dylan's more recent albums and draws out the similarities between his approach to poetry and the work of Catullus, Virgil, and Ovid. This book is a fascinating read for a Dylan fan, but it's also an engaging introduction to his work for people who may be more familiar with ancient literature than modern folk rock, with careful readings of Dylan's lyrics, explorations of his writing process, and a passionate defense of the relevance, subtlety, emotional power, and lasting significance of the songwriter's work.
The book, published by HarperCollins, has just gone on sale on November 21st and is available everywhere. Professor Thomas will be doing some readings in early December. December 4th, he will be in Boston at Newtonville Books at 7 p.m. On December 6th, he'll be in Tulsa, Oklahoma at the Oklahoma Center for the Humanities, also at 7 p.m. Details about these events are in the show notes if you'd like to hear more.
Now, we were so excited to talk to Richard Thomas that we kind of forgot about introductions and just plunged right into our discussion. So please forgive the abrupt opening, and we hope you enjoy our discussion as much as we did.
One of the things that really interests me about this book is it really hits on one of my interests, which is sort of bridging the ancient and the modern, both through influence and through parallels. Is this something that you've always been interested in, or is Dylan a special case for you?
Yeah, the last 20 years or so, I've been interested in what we call the reception of the classical world. In other words, the stream, as I call it, that goes from Homer on down to Seamus Heaney and Dylan and beyond. So classicists used to just sort of stick to the ancient world and see going outside of that as something that was transgressive of the discipline and so on. But that's all changed, and I've sort of changed with it. I always, in school, loved English literature and poetry in particular, and so always had that sort of in my mind, and Dylan sort of became a part of that many, many years ago. Yeah, so it's you know, he's not, and I think what the book does and what I hope it does is show that Dylan is part of a long process that you know, mm-hmm. that the human mind has produced in literature. I mean, he's simply part of it, and his genius is not unlike the genius of the poets that he's been going back to in my area in the last 20 years, Homer, Virgil, mm-hmm. Ovid, and so on.
Yeah, that it's not disconnected. It's part of a similar process.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, the move towards reception studies, both as a separate study, but also, and I think I'm more pleased with this, the integration of it into just simply that there's classical reception, which is a type of scholarship that's separate, but that classicists who do both classical material and more generally reception studies, that those can be integrated within one body of work is something that I think is a really positive move that the field has slowly gone towards, not seeing one as more important than the other.
Right. And it was, you know, if you look at the 19th century, poets like Coleridge and Wordsworth and mm-hmm. Tennyson, maybe particularly Tennyson, and his relationship to poets like Virgil. I mean, they were part of that process, and it's really only in some ways in the 20th century that got disrupted, and that there wasn't a continuity. So I think that's partly also why Dylan is going back to the 19th century and going back through the folk traditions, of which he's a master, to people like Robert Burns and others. Mm-hmm. This is something that he's known about for a long time. He's been in a tradition. I think the more so-called high register poets, i.e. the ones who survive because they get written down, that's really only since 1997 or 2001, but it's not any different from the process that he's always been part of.
Mm-hmm. It's not a break with previous practice. It's an extension of it.
Exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you're right. There is that interesting break with in particularly the first half of the 20th century, where the modernist poets kind of turned their backs on the long literary tradition that went before them, with a few exceptions, of course, like T.S. Eliot.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Right. And Pound to some extent, but Pound, of course, you know, despised some of the classics or claimed to, and was mm-hmm. looking into other corners for his influences. And but yeah, no, exactly. I think it is the moderns, and I think it's things like the First World War. And I mean, if mm-hmm. look at Wilfred Owen, you know, who is a classicist, Arms and the Boy is a version of Arms and the Man, the mm-hmm. Aeneid, but exposing what, you know, what epic poetry is about. It's about the glorification of the killing of young men like himself who died in the trenches. And I mean, had he survived, I think we would have seen him as a modern who would have been doing interesting things with his tradition in the same way that Eliot did.
Yeah, to some extent, that break was caused by the literal killing off of a generation, of poets who were steeped in that tradition, but would have had a different take on it after the war. And
yeah.
We have a few examples of that, but too many of them were lost.
Yeah. Eliot didn't sort of fight, but as... Mm-hmm.
One of the things that really struck me about, as you'd sort of talked about the history in the last 10, 15 years of what you call Dylanology, I know you're not the only one who calls it that, is that many of the insights into sort of Dylan's use of written texts of more modern and classical texts that you describe come about pretty serendipitously, moments of really unexpected connections between a text that somebody happens to be reading and the
I'm going to call them poems over and over again, the songs that they're listening to. One of the things that struck me about that is that I think it demonstrates the value of not being too specialized in one's own interests, scholarship, but also just interests, not restricting yourself too much to, oh, I read Latin poetry, or, oh, I like folk music or rock or whatever, that these insights have come through people who have wide and maybe seemingly disparate interests.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. And the very conscious engagement with the classical text, there is this curious instance back in the song Changing of the Gods in the late 70s, but where he seems to, in a draft, to have been reading Virgil's fourth eclogue, the so-called messianic eclogue. But it really starts in 2001. And when, as I write about in the book, when I heard the verses from Lonesome Day Blues that take one right back to the sixth book of the Aeneid, it was because I had the Aeneid hardwired that I heard that. And then a notorious example of the New Zealand teacher, I think he's British, but Cliff Fell, who was preparing for a class and was reading Ovid, having in 2006, having hardwired Modern Times, and as he put it, suddenly the page started singing to him. So, and then the process since that, I mean, there's been sort of more Googling than having the songs activate the memory of texts right. that one had gotten control of, in other words, through writing about them or teaching. So now I think
a more intentional process now.
I think but useful, useful to have these works, particularly Scott Warmuth is the one who's sort of recovered all of these fragments, or many of them. Also Robert Polito, who's a humanist himself. But what my book, I think, does is show or suggest what Dylan is actually doing by taking on these texts. So I'm trying to interpret their presence in the songs.
Yeah, to some extent, it parallels the process of sort of source scholarship in the 19th and 20th centuries, where first people find the connections, and before the 19th century, but in the classical poetry, I'm thinking of, making the lists and lists of allusions, and then the later second half of the 20th century, developing a theory of intertextuality and developing work on what's going on understanding them and explaining them rather than just finding them.
Right, that's a terrific observation. And my early work on intertextuality was sort of dubbed source criticism because that's what people were
used
familiar
to call it. Yeah.
Yeah. And so you would commentaries that said CF, Homer, Odyssey, book 10 line, whatever, but didn't say why you should CF it. And so
What at all that added to one's understanding of the text to know that it came from Homer.
Right.
There was a reference to Homer. Yeah. And I was thinking about that process.
Yeah. How one goes about, doing this kind of work with specifically with a modern writer like Dylan, where there isn't that whole body of scholarship to already existing to sort of support that sort of work.
And someone with such a large text.
Large
it's not
text,
like Dylan
yeah.
is a small amount of a small work, body of work to get handled on.
And you mentioned in the book that the importance of serendipity, just finding these things by accident, now intentionally looking for them, it seems to me a daunting process.
Yeah, it is. I mean, but of course, with search engines now, you can sort of find stuff out there, and that's and that's what's been happening. And I'm not sure. Dylan wasn't particularly pleased that all of this sort of Googling happened, particularly when it was then contextualized with a sort of wrong theories about plagiarism and so on. All poetry is plagiarism. Nothing is really original. It's how you reshape through your mind and your technical skill what's part of your tradition. And Dylan is like Noah, just like any other poet in that sense. But, when the the Wall Street Journal gets hold of an observation about plagiarism, that's simply how it will present it. And but I think that's changing. I think there's a sense now, and I mean, not just with the Nobel, but I think there's a sense out there that it's now, not just among specialists, but there's a general sense that what Dylan has done, in reshaping works in his tradition is something that is part of his genius, and it's different from what he did early on, but not radically different. What he was doing with Rimbaud in Mr. Tambourine Man or Chimes of Freedom, I think, was similar. But then, his art was also slightly different. He himself has said he didn't know where those songs came from, and they sort of came tumbling out in multiple ways. But the process is more cerebral, maybe, in recent years, but that's still, to do what he does with his now visible tradition is something that nobody else could do other than Bob Dylan.
I think maybe we need to find some way, it's in parallel to the notorious Alexandrian footnote, the way of that classical authors, I know you know this, but the way that classical authors were sometimes said to mark their sources, or mark not where their source was, but that it was from a source, with the "it is said" or some people say before a line or a reference to a story or a myth that comes from a particular source. And it's sort of a, hey, I'm about to do some source work, but it's up to you to figure out where it comes from.
Exactly, yeah. So that Virgil, at the beginning of Aeneid 6, so Daedalus, as the story goes, and the story is, in fact, in the poet Catullus. Mm-hmm. And Virgil wants us to recognize that, because recognizing that and invoking that Catullan context, one of loss, which is what Virgil's also talking about, Daedalus's loss of Icarus, is something that enriches. And Dylan's sort of gone beyond this in a way. I mean, a song like Early Roman Kings, when we all heard the title, thought, oh, great, he's going to talk about Romulus and Remus and the early Roman kings. But it turned out then that he was sort of frustrating that expectation and playing with that expectation by the fact that the Roman kings are a Latino gang from the 1960s from New York. But then the second verse actually has the early Roman kings distributing the corn. So those are the Roman kings. And then and then later he's got Homer, he's got Odysseus taunting the Cyclops. So, he himself has said, there's no meaning in my songs, don't look for meaning. And I think, of course, Dylan is the ultimate unreliable
narrator of his own life. Yeah.
And that raises the interesting question. Of course, it's hard to guess the intentions of a writer, but to what extent Dylan wants us to look for those references, even when he says not to.
Mm-hmm. When you were saying that about Virgil, I mean, that's the thing, that the heavy intertextuality of Roman poets like Catullus or Virgil, I mean, we often say that it's a challenge to the reader. It's a way of marking the sort of intellectual lineage of the poet. There's a lot of reasons that they use the occasional line, but that it's, deeply embeddedly, like the opening of Catullus 64 with its 17 layers of allusion to Callimachean and Hellenistic texts and back to the Medea of Euripides, things like that, that one of the levels of that kind of poetry is a sort of marking of the ideal reader, or an engaging in a commonality of we have the same source material to draw on, you're going to recognize it. Do you think that's what Dylan is doing at all, or is there something else?
No, I think so. I mean, if you look at a song which doesn't have classical intertext on it, a song like Trying to Get to Heaven from Time Out of Mind, 1997, which is when the comeback and the use of texts and the rewriting of other poets really becomes a fundamental part of his art. So that in the book I have several pages of the sort of gospel, folk, and blues lines that are sort of basically sort of taken over, rewritten, and create the song of somebody who's in trouble. You know, we don't know what the trouble is, and that's part of the mystery of it. When I was in Missouri, they would not let me be. Who are they? And you know, what did not letting him be, the singer be, consist of? But, you know, you've got House of the Rising Sun is in there. John the Revelator, who Dylan about in his Nobel lecture, is one of the things that he absorbed. He talks in that lecture about absorbing the vernacular of the folk world. And I think in many ways he's become all of these characters, or his writing voice and his singing voice has become just a part of this tradition. And I think that's exactly what Virgil's doing with his tradition, back to Homer.
So do you think you've kind of answered that already, that he seemed a little annoyed that people were publicizing or talking about the specifics of some of those borrowings. Do you think he wanted them to be not the folk intertext, which I agree, there's a little bit of a different quality to that, because that is part of a larger tradition that he expects his audience to have inside them as well, I think. But with the more literary references, do you think he's picking them up because he wants us to recognize their context and make those intertextual connections? Or is it more of a, those are lines that he likes, those resonances, and he's going to write that song, but he doesn't necessarily expect everyone to catch them, something in between? Is it different for every example?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, I think early on, say on Love and Theft, with a song like Lonesome Day Blues, which has the Virgil slightly worked, but also has the Japanese Confessions of a Yakuza, and also has Hakuin in the same song. I think that is part of his art, sort of rewriting. And I think he has an ear and an eye in reading for what is poetic and what he can rework in his art. But I don't think he cares on some level what what we think or know. He cares only about the art and how well it works. Now that I think changed a bit. So after 2006, when Ovid and Henry Timrod, the Confederate poet, were spotted, why did he 6 years later in 2012 so noticeably? And he knew about the Googlers at that point.
He knew you were looking for it. Yeah,
knew people were looking for it. And is it becoming a game, a sort of a nodding and winking to the to the audience, I mean, to the reader, to the listener? Maybe partly, but the songs, you know, Tempest, the songs of Tempest are, in my view, among the very greatest songs that he's ever written. I mean, I just, so there may be some playfulness, but that playfulness is also part of the classical tradition. Virgil has acrostics, you know, written about the gates of war, and he has the word M-A-R-S starting four consecutive lines for Mars. So that, you know, at one of the most serious moments of his epic, he's also being playful, and that's what poets do, right?
And he doesn't sacrifice those four lines are not the worst because he had to move them around in order to create the acrostic. He's not creating a lesser piece of work because he wanted to throw in a joke.
Yeah,
he can do both because he's Virgil.
Right. If you or I did it, they would be worse. But Virgil and Dylan do it. It's that's what art and poetry and songwriting at that level are all about.
Yeah, in some ways you could see it not so much as, I don't know, but one could imagine it being not so much a playful, now it's a game, but that knowing that people are looking for it frees him up in a way to use a little bit more, with the expectation that, as well as being good songs for those who know nothing about the intertexts, that he can now expect his audience to be able to find some of them. He's able to have now sort of a constructed ideal audience who is going to be on the lookout for odd things. So not a game necessarily, but another layer he can add to his work now. Now he can have that layer too, and know that some people will be able to pull those intertextual resonances in, and that for others who don't, it doesn't matter because the poems are still masterpieces. Songs are still masterpieces on their own.
Right, absolutely. And that's the same. You can read Homer or Virgil just without any knowledge of the traditions, because they're just such great expressions of what it means to be human and to die, what empire is about in all of its problematic nature, what war is about, what homecoming is about, or the ability for home to achieve homecoming.
Mm-hmm. The intertexts add, but they are not required for the work to be good.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you need them, then it becomes sort of rigid and sort of art purely for art's sake and artificial, essentially. Mm-hmm. That's what we know about those traditions, right? The least accessible poetry of Hellenistic poetry. I won't name the names because I have been too woke on some of them, but ones that are impenetrable without having a lexicon.
Right, like the now lost, we can say this because it's lost, so it's not a problem, but the, was it Nepos or I can't remember who it is who did the work that needed a commentary within its own generation.
Oh, right,
Among the Neoterics, that as soon as it was published, it needed a commentary because nobody could understand it.
Exactly.
And we don't have it anymore, and there's probably a reason for that.
Right, and Euphorion, it starts in the Hellenistic period, but that absolutely. And it's Virgil who there are parts of Catullus is a great poet, so even when he's being allusive has these references that are not easily catchable, he's still writing poetry, but things could have developed in an interior way. Virgil came along and
rested the tradition around again.
Partly, I mean, Eliot's essay, What is a Classic, is a problematic essay, but I think it's right that Virgil, you can't define a classic without going through Virgil, because that the maturity of language, the sort of moment in history and the genius of a particular poet. And if you think about Dylan, you're dealing with pretty much the same confluence of,
historical moment and maturity of tradition and individual talent.
So although they might not have the same cultural impact as Dylan, are there other songwriters whose work would repay such an intertextual reading, especially with respect to the classical material? And you mentioned in the book, the two albums that you brought with you to the US, the other one was Leonard Cohen. That might be an example.
Yeah, he's your guy, right?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. There's no hometown bias here at all.
Right. Well, I first heard Leonard Cohen when I was 16 years old. Or was it 17? A friend of my older brother's brought over songs of Leonard Cohen, and that that's just the album along with Blonde on Blonde that I brought with me to the States. Sold the rest off to travel through Greece. And Leonard Cohen, of course, is a poet first. And Dylan showed him in Dylan's writing of 64, 65, 66, Dylan showed him, as he showed many others, Springsteen later on, that poetry and music are compatible. And so that's part of the revolutionary nature. So Leonard Cohen, I consider him number one, as Bob said. Bob is number zero, and Leonard is number one.
That seems fair, yeah.
I recognize that in Leonard Cohen, and I'm not sure that, I mean, I don't think there's much in the way of deliberate classical allusions or intertexts in Cohen. I really think it's something that Dylan almost sort of reinvented, and I think it, Eliot, the love song of Alfred J. Prufrock is right there in Desolation Row. So yeah. I think Dylan is doing this from early on in ways that other post-60s songwriters aren't doing so much. So Joni Mitchell, I don't think so much. I think in the case of Joni Mitchell, Leonard Cohen, Neil Young, that's not the process that's working there. It's more a it's a freer process, maybe, perhaps.
The other songwriter I was thinking of is Sting.
Yeah.
Not so much with classical references, but a lot of English poetry references and biblical references.
That's in the post-Police stuff.
Post-Police stuff.
Yeah.
Though even in the Police days, he did have a few, mm-hmm. you know, he mentions Nabokov and... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he has a couple of references. I wouldn't say he's sort of working so much with the text.
No, not
as
so much.
Just
no.
The cultural touchstones.
Yeah.
That's more common, I mm-hmm. think, alluding to a name or a person.
Yeah. But he does have lines from Shakespeare in his later, his mm-hmm. solo work. Yeah.
And I'm less familiar with that, so I wouldn't, but that sounds interesting. And Leonard Cohen, too, with the Bible. I mean, obviously,
yeah.
Hallelujah mm-hmm. is an example, but there are other instances too. I mean,
I know some of Cohen's works better than others, but I have never sat down with it and tried to do. I mean, one of the things that your book has made me now want to do is, and I thank you for this because this is a good thing to want to do, is to listen to some of my favorite works with a different ear. Because I have tended to sort of think more within the musical tradition to hear the quotations and the intertexts within the musical, both like the actual melodies, but the, you know, how Dylan picks up on Guthrie or something like that.
Right. Yeah.
But to listen to it for a wider, and to think about, not just listen for that, but to think about what that means and what process is going on, hasn't been how I've been thinking about some of these songwriters, and who knows, maybe there's something there.
Yeah, no, I think I think that's a good mission. Yeah. Yeah, and it's, you know, I mean, Dylan with Columbus Stockade, the Guthrie, it's not just Guthrie, but the song that he probably got from listening to Guthrie, that then became this song that he never recorded, California Brown Eyed Girl, about this girl who Avril, who was a dancer in New York that he was sort of living with in. The very early,
yeah, right, yeah.
Period. And that song, Columbus Stockade, is a, you know, a guy in prison who's feeling betrayed by a woman who's, you know, leave me, darling, I don't mind. And Avril had headed off to California, so if you hear, you know, he didn't publish it, he sang it to her over the phone, apparently. But you know, if you hear Columbus Stockade, it's meaning, the imprisoned sort of lover who's been abandoned. Dylan, just from the very beginning, had this ability to create characters in his song who connected to the art that was that he was sort of hardwiring in those years. Mm-hmm.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Pivoting a little bit, but I think in some ways this is the same, another parallel kind of question. You know, I was thinking about the difference between working with ancient text and working with Dylan. And one of them is that when we study ancient poets, we often have very little or no biographical information. We very rarely have any access to multiple versions or to their writing process. You know, they aren't in a vacuum. There's a historical context, but in terms of their personal creative context, you know, often we have worse than no information about their biography.
Right.
When you're working on Dylan, about whom there's such a wealth of information, but, as you already alluded to, kind of presents such a shifting and contradictory story of his own life and his own writing process, you know, saying, oh, I wrote Blowing in the Wind in 10 minutes. And you rightly sort of point out in the book that maybe, or maybe that was a little bit of an oversimplification. Yeah. How does it sort of compare when you're studying these poets about whom we really come down to having just the finished product and have to recreate the process compared to Dylan, where we have information about the process, but we kind of can't trust it.
Right. And I think it really becomes the same thing. So that the lives, mm-hmm. the ancient lives, as you know, of Virgil and Horace and so on, people are very skeptical about many of the details. Some people mm-hmm. skeptical about all of them. I'm less so. I think there are truths. How Virgil composed, you know, wrote a bunch of lines in the morning, then deleted, excised, sort of licked into shape is the term. Mm-hmm. That's where the term licked into shape comes from, of a bear licking its mm-hmm. young into shape. So that's useful if it's true. But does it, you know, that we really don't know anything about Virgil doesn't matter, because it's the art of Virgil that his life, his circumstances, his genius created that is the focus we care about. And mm-hmm. I say it's the same thing about Dylan. What do we really know about Dylan? You know, his mother reportedly said, you know, people don't know Bob. He's a really kind, gentle man. Everybody should have a son like Bobby. One of the Nobel awarders said he seemed like a very kind man. So what does, you know, when Dylan on stage is singing Positively 4th Street, you got a lot of nerve to say you are my friend. I wish that for just one time you could stand inside my shoes and just for that one moment I could be you. Yes, I wish that for just one time you could stand inside my shoes. You'd know what a drag it is to see you. Does that sound like a nice man? But that's a song. So in a way, I think not having biographical information is liberating. Not, you know, his school record disappeared from the school fairly early on. So obviously he with the help of somebody or other, made it disappear. And, you know, one detail I dug up about his belonging to the Latin club and what they were doing on a specific day.
I did love that. I really did. Whatever the value of it in the, you know, larger sense necessarily. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it does connect us very intimately, it feels like, to a sort of moment in his life. And that is pretty amazing.
Yeah. And we don't know much. You know, the people around him don't talk much. I mean, the people who are closest to him say next to nothing. You know, people like Sarah Dillon or Newworth, you know, who, with whom he shared stuff, but I think he probably didn't share, he's never shared the, you know, the inner Dylan, the artist, mm-hmm. you know, what he was thinking about when he wrote this with anyone. I think he saw from early on that was dangerous in some odd way, maybe, and that as an artist he was going to only let so much out.
Sometimes we see, I think there's a pattern of some kinds of artists who feel very vulnerable when they reveal about themselves, and the only the way that they can reveal about themselves is through their art, because that is a vulnerability they can control, and that unmediated sort of sharing is too vulnerable. That's a bit pop psychoanalysis on my part, but I mean, I think we can kind of see that with people who write and produce and paint and all the, you know, very, what seemingly very vulnerable and raw and emotional, personal material, but who are very somehow private outside of their art.
Right. And so, you know, someone like Bruce Springsteen, whom I love, is sort of the opposite. He will sort of tell us about his politics, and he'll chide the audience if they aren't understanding his position in Empty Sky and something like that.
Yeah, I wonder what Dylan thinks of the layers of Catullus 16, if he knows it, though I imagine that one wasn't taught in his class at the time.
Probably not. I don't think he did enough Latin to get to that in Latin. I do think his teacher, I think she may have read the Odi et Amo, I Love and I Hate, you ask why that is. I don't know, but I feel it happening and I'm being tortured. And he writes.
Yeah, that makes it into even introductory textbooks often, just as
right,
an example. Exactly. Yeah.
And that's also pretty simple enough mm-hmm. to sort of present to a beginning Latin group. And there's mm-hmm. a letter that he writes to Suze Rotolo that seems almost to be alluding to that, you know, when she's mm-hmm. in Italy studying art. And good for us that she did, because it created songs like Boots of Spanish Leather and I Want You, and so on. But I think that, you know, I think there may actually be a little bit of Catullus in there. But
mm-hmm. The reason I mentioned Catullus 16 is, apart from the obscenities of the opening and the ending, which make it a favorite of mine to read in class, but apart from that, the core message of it, which is Catullus saying, you think you know me from my poems and you attack my masculinity for that, but the poem and the poet are not the same. Don't think you know me just because you've read my poems.
Yeah.
Now you can deconstruct that again to say, but wait a minute, isn't this a poem in which you're telling me that poem and poet are not the same? What should I believe?
I'll do this. I'm teaching Catullus this term, and I learn all the poems, and so I actually say what I'm not going to say on the air. I will X you about it.
Yes.
And Y you for saying that I'm like this because of... because my poems are somewhat risque, but Dylan, you know, the Dylan's discovery of Rimbaud, for which various people take credit, as Suze Rotolo, Dylan writes about this in Chronicles a bit, but Dylan's discovery of I is another, you know, is which the Roman poets you
certainly know,
millennia ago, and that poem that you rightly pick on, Catullus 16, is mm-hmm. precisely about that, and that Dylan mm-hmm. had been practicing that art, but that he saw in that statement that Rimbaud, the person, is somebody other. I mean, this is now conventional sort of narratological theory, but...
Yeah, but it does take coming to when you're either because you're young and haven't been exposed to it yet, or because it hadn't yet become sort of conventional wisdom. It does take coming to, I think.
Yeah, and when we hear a song, we want to, particularly when it's somebody like Dylan or Neil Young or Leonard Cohen, we want the sentiment to be the sentiment of the historical Bob Dylan or the historical Robert Zimmerman, I guess, if we're trying to identify the sentiment of the song with the person of the singer rather than the persona of the singer. That's I think, a human impulse that we want to know. We have a curiosity about the artists that we love, and we want to, you know, get close to what they're actually thinking rather than the thought that they're turning into art through various devices.
Yeah, I mean, that's the central paradox of, like, the Roman elegists, I think, that they play with, and someone like Ovid plays with, even more so, that they know you want to know them through their poetry, and they're always playing with letting you in or not letting you in. I don't know that Dylan is as focused on that, perhaps, that, you know, that's not as much the point of his songs as it is, I think, the point of some of, say, Ovid's Amores.
Yeah.
But I think it's still a tension there that he knows, and you refer to this when you talk about how he sort of seems to have a paradoxical relationship to performing, that he finds it really hard to be so visible and yet is only happy on stage.
Yeah.
That's a paraphrase of what he said, but something like that.
Right. Whereas Leonard Cohen, you know, only went on stage, or not only, but mostly when he got ripped off and had to sort of build up his...
To pay the bills.
So someone like Ovid, exactly, the Amore is... So I was about to sing of epic, but Cupid came along and stole a foot away. So now I'm writing elegiac couplets, which you can't do epic in that meter. So I guess I'll have to write love poetry. Here I am writing love poetry, but I don't have a girlfriend or boyfriend yet to write love poetry. So this existential impossibility of being in love, but
with no object
doesn't exist. But then he finds
and then the identity is a love poet, yeah.
Yeah. And I think the exile poems are similar. The option of which Dylan has so brilliantly integrated into modern times, a number of those poems.
Yes, which I think is kind of wonderful, because I do think, just from the perspective of the exile poems, are an understudied and underappreciated element of Ovid. I'm not, and I haven't really worked on Ovid, and they're underappreciated by me as well. But I do think that I've done a little bit of work recently teaching them, actually, and have realized that I should have been paying more attention to them.
Yeah. I taught a course in the evening school, extension school at Harvard a couple of years ago on just the exile poems. And there's a lot of interesting stuff there. And of course, Dylan read it in Peter Green's Penguin translation, with fantastic translation.
Which is a very good one, yeah.
And again, sort of selecting lines. No one could ever say that I took up arms against you. You know, that's to Augustus, the emperor who's exiled him, but Dylan, in Working Man Blues number 2, that line becomes the line to a lover who's no longer on the scene, and but you know, becomes a line of regret and longing in just a completely different way. But Dylan read that line, precisely that line, and saw its potential for his song. So that's exactly, as you know as well as I do, that's exactly what someone like Virgil or Catullus is doing.
So one of the sort of larger messages that I take from this work, and I think is it really lines up with how I think about things, is that it's useful to sometimes step out of the confines of your field. Obviously, studying Latin poetry has affected your understanding of Dylan. But I wonder, has it worked the other way for you? Has working on Dylan affected how you approach Latin poetry?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that the short answer is yes. I mean, I'm still processing the ways. So I've done, the freshman seminar that I've done since 2004, I did partly because I started seeing what Dylan was doing since Love and Theft in 2001. I guess in a way, it's contributed to the sort of the dropping of boundaries, chronological and even sort of generic boundaries that I see. It's allowed me to see that somebody like Virgil, who we're told, would walk into a theater and people would get up and applaud, or that the crowd, he had to duck into somebody's house when the crowd noticed him, that Virgil was, a rock star essentially of his day. So that Virgil was pop. He was pop who became a classic because of the quality of his pop, whereas most of the pop music of the 60s is a lot of it, too much of it is still embedded in my head, but but it didn't last, whereas Dylan's did. So it's helped me to see, to try and reach a synchronic understanding of what it would have been like to get up some morning in the year 37 or 35 BCE and read Virgil's eclogues and realize that the world of Roman literature was utterly transformed, never to be the same again. I mean, Virgil was taught, we're told, was taught in his own lifetime. So what poets are taught in their own lifetime? Bob Dylan, in my seminar, obviously. But
people who are writing within their own lifetime and while they're still producing as well, right. I think. Because sometimes, once the body of work is produced, the writer might discourteously hang around for a while, but people feel like they're gone, but he's still producing things that are still worth studying.
And it's also another detail, that helps me read the ancients through Dylan. I mean, that we're told that Virgil, nobody could read Virgil like Virgil, that the effect of Virgil reading. You listen to my friend David Ferry, the poet who's just translated the Aeneid, a wonderful version of that. Hearing him read it, he knows what he meant with the poetry of it. Dylan is the same. There's not a single song, not one, that I prefer, including Henrik's All Along the Watchtower, which I love. But Dylan then took on that arrangement and never sang the pre-Henrik's version. but I'd even include that in saying that, it's the person of Dylan, the appearance, the voice, the look, the mystique, the, you know, what the, the image that you've created of him in your head, that that is part of the performance and the lyrics. So, you know, that, as in many other ways, a poet like Virgil, you know, the supreme poet of his day, and a songwriter like Dylan, poet like Dylan, I'm comfortable calling him that, are really the same. So that, and when Dylan is gone, you know, we'll have, that's why archive at Tulsa is so important, and the careful preservation of the record of Bob Dylan that will allow, you know, whatever future he has. I mean, I think he'll be around in 200 years. I'm not sure in what ways he'll be around in 200 years, but he'll be away, at least around in the way that, that Wordsworth and Blake and Coleridge are around, who are read still by the young, not just by English professors, right?
Yeah, I think so. One, predicting the future and and the future of aesthetic taste is a bit difficult, but I think it, it he has as he's certainly as likely to be around as anybody producing in the 20th century, let's put it that way. Assuming there is any memory of the 20th century on the world, we haven't all been wiped off of it.
Right.
Yes, the monument more lasting than bronze.
Exactly.
I think he participates in.
It's funny that Dylan hasn't engaged Horace to
monument. With Horace.
But, I think he, maybe the next album, I'm hoping there will be a there'll be another one, but that would be fun.
There'll be a Carpe Diem moment or two at least. Or maybe that's too obvious. Maybe it'll have to be something a little less obvious. There was one point that I just wanted to bring up because I kept seeing, you focus understandably more on Virgil and Ovid because those are the clear actual intertextual allusions that he has in the more recent poems, songs, whatever. But one thing, because Catullus is, for me, my favorite as well, you mentioned that you like him. I am very fond of Catullus. It's not only Catullus 16 in that poetic persona issue, but I was struck by when you talked about Catullus 11, the goodbye poem to Lesbia, that's quite famous. And you tied it to a couple of his songs more in mood than in specific allusions or sort of in the way he can manipulate and evoke feelings of sadness and goodbyes and things. But the other thing that that struck me is the way that I think there's a commonality between the two poets in terms of how they can mix sort of beauty and tenderness along with brutally cutting insults and also humor. I mean, Catullus 11 to me is so much that. There's that lovely, lovely sapphic simile and at the same time, you know, a really quite vile message to Lesbia. And the song Don't Think Twice is the one that comes to mind for me. I was raised on 60s Dylan, so that's what's most in my head. But that sweetness, there's some lovely bittersweet lyrics in that song, but you just kind of wasted my precious time has always been the line to me that is just the most brutal rejection you can make to someone. And being able to mix those two things, I think that's something that I see as a, I'm not saying it's influence necessarily, but a commonality between the two of them. And I don't know if that comes out of actually having read some of these poems or if it's just something that they both came to.
Right. Yeah, there is a classicist who, following on some of my work in the early 2000s, claimed that Dylan had been reading Catullus and sort of lined up some of the poems that you talk about. And I don't think that's the case. I don't think Dylan was doing what he did. I don't think Dylan was doing in the 60s with classical texts. I think it was an accident of two youthful geniuses. So Catullus was in his 20s and didn't get much past his 20s ever. And, you know, I think did have an affair, which didn't work out well, but his art is what sort of kicked in with whatever situation. And yeah, and I think that the ability, Catullus 11 is a good instance, and ending with, you know, let her make love with her 300 adulterers and not look back for my love, which, and then even in the sapphic simile, for my love, which through her fault has not been like the flower on the edge of the meadow has been not crushed by the plow, but has been nicked, touched by the plow. Mm-hmm. So the flower is still alive, but it's dying. And so Catullus still has feelings, but they're dying and they will die. So even at that, with that sort of brutal moment. Now, is that true? And you just kind of wasted my precious time? Yeah, which is one of the, you know, one of the toughest lines, but don't think twice, it's all right. But in, is it really all right?
Yeah.
Dylan, is he all right with it? And so I think it's the same. Why would you do a song like that if it was really all right?
Yes.
And then he'll keep doing that. I mean, Idiot Wind, you know, playing Idiot Wind in a Rolling Thunder review when his wife, Sarah, the divorce is going to go through the next year. You know, she's in the audience and, but then, you know, there are versions, we're idiots, babe. It's a wonder that we still know how to breathe. You know, so it's,
right.
There's always, yeah, there's not, I think, I can't think of a song where there's finality, because if there's finality, why write a song about it?
There has to be some sort of tension or progress to be made or a question that's left open.
Yeah, some residue of something that mattered. So was the time completely wasted?
Yeah.
So is that again a moment, the momentary anger of the singer who's trying to convince himself that he wasted his precious time? Who knows?
Yeah.
We're getting a little lit critty here.
I know. I find it very hard not to. It's but I think that's, I mean, I think that's the value of, I don't know if I've mentioned that I very much enjoyed your book. I enjoyed your writing and your engagement, which was, I enjoyed the balance of sort of the literary criticism and the personal and the, and the contextualizing of setting it within, you know, the various periods, both of Dylan's life and the historical moments.
Thank you. How did your dad like it?
He liked it. It is funny. I think he has a slightly more paradoxical approach to Dylan. Like my parents love Dylan's music and have always loved it and have sung it all their lives. But he's a little less enchanted with Dylan the man, perhaps.
Right. Yeah. So he's a Joni person.
Perhaps a little bit more of one. Yeah. And of some of the but he really enjoyed he put it down and he said, now I just need to go listen to more music.
And I hope what it will do is help bring people to the later music. You know, I mean, there are a lot of people out there who think, well, until the Nobel may have even thought that Bob Dylan wasn't with us anymore, but definitely realized he was doing 100 shows a year and producing these colossally brilliant albums the last 20 years.
Well, I think it did that for both me and my dad, because I just went out and bought the last three on iTunes.
Oh, okay.
And before, you know, over the last week, because I didn't know them well. I had heard some of them. Thunder, is it? That one and Decane. Yeah, I can't remember titles. Why doesn't he just number them all like poets? I could do that.
Those are both the opening songs of Times and Tempest, too.
Yeah, and I think they wear out perhaps as singles a little bit more too, so that I'd heard them and a few others, but I didn't know all of them. And I think my dad's interested in picking those up too. And so I also appreciate that because I do like being reminded of what's out there.
Yeah.
Reasons to listen to things. Maybe to wrap up then, I'll ask you the question one should never ask a scholar. So what is the next book? Or has, you know, you wrote this book, obviously in part in reaction to the Nobel win or as a consequence of that moment. Has it made you think about continuing working on Dylan? Have you any interest in continuing this process with someone else?
Yeah. So I thought when I did it that I would get back to working on Tacitus, who's a new found research interest of mine, the greatest Roman historian, and some Dylan mentions and has been reading, I think, and engaging. That's not why I got into that. But then in the process of writing the book, I've gotten two or three ideas of other Dylan projects. So I always tell my students to work on something that is firing you up. Don't do a dissertation on something that isn't sort of coming from deep down in your in your. And so to apply that, I'll only teach the Dylan seminar every 4 years. So the next time will be 2020, and long may he run, and maybe we'll have another album. But I
keep giving you more material. Yeah.
But I want to also dig around in the archives in Tulsa, which have just been opened to scholars fairly recently. And there are a couple of periods that I'm particularly interested in. So I want to look at that and from a textual point of view, partly, but and not just looking to see if I can find more classics, but looking at the process of writing and rewriting that there's a bit in the book. I have a bit on the early versions of Tangled Up in Blue that nobody is and that are in the archives. So, I want to do that, but I also have a couple of projects that would involve just me reading and thinking and listening that are out there that I think I will do. So I'm on leave in the spring, so I plan to get out to Tulsa a couple of times and so I think Tacitus will be there when I come back to him, but my teaching is all going to be the usual, but which doesn't exclude Dylan. Dylan comes into almost every class I teach, so.
Well, I mean, that's one of the values. We were talking about that before we started recording, that I think that's one of the values of doing this kind of work, is it does give you a connection to students and to people who, and to non-students. It allows people to come to the classical texts who might feel they are otherwise off limits or uninteresting or not for them, because if Dylan is coming to them, why can't they? And if they're interested in Dylan and read your book, you've done that work of bridging that gap for them.
Yeah.
And showing them that they can read Catullus too. There's no reason they can't.
Right.
It's right there beside their Dylan.
Tight connection to my heart, as Bob says. But yeah, no, absolutely. And I hope that that's what this book will do. I hope it will be, my literature does okay, but I have a student who was in the Dylan seminar last year. Is now a sophomore and he's doing Catullus, so he had good Latin. Three of the students had good Latin. And he was talking about Achilles to a fellow student, a Harvard undergraduate, who didn't know who Achilles was. And so he talked about the Trojan War, and that student didn't really know what the Trojan War was either. And so, you know, in 1974, when Nixon was nabbed, there's a photo of him and Haldeman and Rosemary Woods on the cover of Newsweek magazine with the Watergate tapes entangling them, which was an allusion to the Laocoon statue group from book Aeneid, where the serpents are sent to kill Laocoon, who warned against bringing the Trojan horse into Troy. So that image could be on Newsweek only 40 years ago, 40 plus years ago, but it could never be on Newsweek right now, I think, because of...
no one would be able to make that connection, yeah.
And it's true that canons are problematic, but canons have existed for centuries because of something about works like the Iliad and the Odyssey, the Aeneid, and others that that are timeless. And if those get lost, as they're in the process of being lost at some level, then humans, and not just the humanities, but humans suffer from that. So, yeah, I'm hoping that, and I think Dylan realizes that. I think Dylan is, just as he's bringing the American standards back to life in performance and in the last three albums, I think that's what he's doing with the classics as well, sending us back there and preserving them.
And opening them up and saying.
Yeah, exactly. And sure.
One of the reasons canons can be problematic is when they're exclusionary. And so to say these classical texts are not only for a little elite and they are open to you is part of what makes those canonical texts important again.
Yes.
To say that they aren't a marker of elite the past. They are something that is meaningful to everyone.
Yeah. And they were all pop in the sense of being popular with the people. I mean, the Athenians sort of heard Homer constantly in the context of festivals and other contexts. So, and that's why, I mean, it's interesting that we're in an age of translation, probably six or seven poetic translations of the Aeneid since 2000. And and now the first woman translator of the Odyssey, Emily Wilson, a fantastic translation. I'll put in a plug for that. But
yes, we're waiting on that book arriving ourselves because I am very much looking forward to reading that.
Yeah,
and, very much.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, Fagel's Odyssey is the one that Dylan read, added. I think Dylan says he read the Odyssey way back, and I think he did. I mean, I think it's pretty big in American high school curricula, but I mean, it's the stuff is alive, and we just have to get the message out somehow. When we have people urging us to all send all of our students to STEM classes, you wonder where that all ends. But I think there's been some crack in that, in the notion that that is a universal panacea, that you can do that without living an examined life, which should involve thinking about literature, listening to music, and so on.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a pretty good note to end on, really, the examined life.
Well, it's great to chat, and thank you.
Yes, and thank you very much for the book and for this conversation.
Yes.
It was really stimulating.
It was.
Okay, well, I much enjoyed it, and it's great to talk to another classicist about Bob Dylan.
Yes.
For more information on this podcast, check out our website, www.alliterative.net, where you can find links to the videos, blog posts, sources, and credits, and all our contact info.
And please check out our Patreon, where you can pledge to support this show and our video project. You can go directly to the videos at youtube.com/alliterative.
Our email is on the website, but the easiest way to get in touch with us is Twitter. I'm at AvenSarah, AvenSarah.
And I'm at alliterative. To keep up with the podcast, subscribe on your favorite podcast app or to the feed on the website.
And if you've enjoyed it, consider leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. It helps us a lot. We'll be back soon with more musings about the connections around us. Thanks for listening.
Bye.